There is an epidemic of rape in the United States. That epidemic has its epicenter in Native American communities. One third of all Native American women will be raped in their lifetimes. That shocking statistic underpins the work of my guest, Sarah Deer, who has written a new book about how rampant rape has historically been a tool of colonialism and continues to be so. Sarah Deer is a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's a 2014 MacArthur Fellow. She's the co-author of three books on tribal law and co-editor of Sharing Our Stories of Survival, Native Women Surviving Violence. Her new book is called The Beginning and End of Rape, Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America. Welcome to Uprising, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, how historically has rape been used as a tool of war, of colonialism against Native communities? And how much documentation even exists to show that violence?
Well, you know, it's not that hard to find the historical accounts. And if you go all the way back to Columbus, you know, there was a passage written in a journal by one of his shipmates talking about, you know, the minute he landed, you know, he captured a woman, a Native woman, and he brought her upon the ship and he raped her. And there was no sort of apology for that kind of behavior. There was an arrogance and assumption that the land was free for taking, the people were free for enslaving, and the women were free for raping. And so that mentality that comes with colonialism is very much intertwined with assault on women.
Now, the United States has never fully reconciled with the project of colonialism of Native American lands and people. But there have been apologies offered. And in your book, you tackle this issue of apology and, you know, just the acknowledgement on the surface level that something severe, dire, horrifically wrong happened. What do you make of this apology and how does it work when you're talking about rape?
Well, the government, the U.S. government has issued a couple of apologies. One came from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and one came from President Obama. You know, and there's sort of mixed feelings about apologies as a general principle. I mean, what do they really do? But, you know, when I think about it from a rape victim's perspective, just an acknowledgement of the harm that has been done can go a long way towards validating a survivor's experience. The problem I see with the apologies that have been issued is they don't confront the issue of sexual violence. They apologize for land removal, for the Trail of Tears, for boarding schools, you know, a lot of the horrific things that Native people have experienced. But somehow rape is not on that list. And it's interesting because murder is, you know, homicide and Indian killing is, but somehow, even though rape is a lesser serious crime than murder, we still don't talk about it. And I think that just demonstrates the shame that people have with even the word, talking about rape as a concept.
Right. You, in your book, make a note about using the word rape rather than sexual assault or sexual violence or sexual abuse and these kind of clinical terms that have become substitutes for the word rape. Why is language so important?
Well, I think, you know, the terms sexual assault and sexual abuse are certainly valid labels for crimes in a contemporary criminal justice system. But, you know, the crime is really not about sex. And so I choose to use the word rape when possible to make sure that people understand it's a political issue. And it's not just a clinical harm that happens.
So let's talk about law, actually, because that's really important when we talk about rape and sexual violence in Native American communities, because of the nature, the pretty complex nature of legal boundaries when it comes to Native American communities and tribes. How has the law been, in a way, used to undermine the claims of women who are raped?
Well, frankly, just as a short answer to that is the legal system is broken, so it can't address, you know, the harms that are happening. But the real issue is around the taking of jurisdiction away from tribes, taking the power away from tribes to make decisions about their own community and to take action when harm comes to the community. You know, that's, again, sort of a metaphor for how rape victims experience the crime. Control is taken away. You don't have the right to decide what happens with your body and your soul. And so when the tribes were confronted with this loss of jurisdiction, it feels helpless. It feels like, well, if something happens, you know, in our community, there's not very much that we can do to stop it. And so that's why the legal system has a huge role to play in why Native women experience such a high rate of sexual assault and rape.
So let's talk about the extent of rape in Native American communities today. You know, one might argue, well, the project of colonialism is over, and that you don't have white men going and raping Native American women anymore. How do you characterize what is happening today? Why are the numbers so high?
Well, I think that without a system to hold people accountable, it's very, very difficult to stop rape. You need victims to come forward, although I hate to put that burden on any individual victim, but if you're going to stop rape, you need victims to come forward, and then you need some sort of legal accountability for that person. And if that's not happening, the message to both victims and perpetrators is, you know, nothing will be done, and I can either get away with this or I will suffer and nobody will respond. And so the numbers are sky high. Without accountability, you simply can't begin to address the crisis.
And so does the issue of rape become part, however, of a complex of social problems facing the communities that are linked to lack of sovereignty and poverty, et cetera?
Absolutely. I mean, so Native people experience the highest rates of PTSD in the nation, four times as high PTSD. And what causes that PTSD? Well, very often, child abuse and sexual violence are the triggers for developing the post-traumatic stress disorder. And post-traumatic stress disorder leads to all kinds of ills. It leads to mental illness. It can lead to physical illness. It can lead to addiction. And so if we're really honest about some of our social issues in Indian country, we have to address rape, because it's sort of the foundation of many of the challenges that we experience as Native people.
How much of it also has to do with how Native American people are viewed by non-Native communities, by the majority dominant communities here in the United States? People just, we just passed the annual Halloween tradition, and it's often a popular idea, sadly still popular idea, for people to dress up in tribal gear, wearing headdresses and feathers. And does that also play into the fetishization of Native women?
I think absolutely it does. And the dehumanization of Native women is really central to being able to attack them, right? If you don't see Native people as human, then, you know, they're just a character. They don't have humanity. Then, you know, it's much easier to attack them. I think the more dangerous thing besides the really offensive use of headdresses and feathers is the Pocahontas kind of syndrome that we are seeing, where Native costumes for women are very sexy. They have very short skirts and they're very temptuous. And that really plays into the sexualized, racialized view of Native women. And the other issue, frankly, is that we are invisible. So, you know, if the only time you see an Indian image is on a sexy costume, then that's what you think of Native people. Mm-hmm. So the invisibility and the marginalization of our communities also plays a big role.
Is there a difference between the epidemic of rape here in the United States and also our response to it with Canada? First Nations communities in Canada have been very active on drawing attention to rape, but also killings and disappearances of Native women there, of First Nations women there. Is there a comparison, or is it more of a continuum?
I think that there's definitely a comparison. I think the history of Canada's treatment of Native people and the history of the United States treatment of Native people are very similar. There's a lot of overlap in terms of the policies and the destruction that occurred. You know, now in the United States, I haven't seen as much attention paid to missing and disappeared and murdered women. But I do believe, just on my own research, that we have a very similar problem in the United States, where we have hundreds of missing Native women that are not being looked for. And I just don't think we have put the same level of attention to it that the activists in Canada have.
Now, let's going back to the issue of law and how that has worked against Native women. We'd had you on our program to discuss the Violence Against Women Act, which is something that Congress has struggled for years to deal with, how to treat Native American women in that act. And you write about that in your book as well. What is the current status of the Violence Against Women Act and how Native women are treated in that act?
Sure. Well, it was signed in 2013. And what it did, in addition to a lot of pieces for, you know, a lot of different groups of people, the Native specific sections of VAWA did change one aspect of jurisdiction that will, in the long run, help tribes do a better job of protecting their women. But that jurisdiction restoration only applies to crimes of domestic violence. So it only applies when your victim and your perpetrator have a relationship or a former relationship. And in that case, if a non-Indian commits that crime against an Indian woman, then he can be held accountable in tribal court. So it's a very tiny sliver of the change that is needed. And so rape is not included in that. If you were raped by an acquaintance or a neighbor or a stranger or a doctor or a police officer, and you're not in a relationship with that person, the tribe still lacks the authority to take action if the perpetrator is non-Indian.
And so is there a lot of work that needs to be done on the issue on within the realm of tribal law to address this?
Absolutely. And this is our biggest challenge, right? Because we have been able to go to Congress and make them understand that the jurisdiction has to be restored. It should have never been taken in the first place. But now that the jurisdiction has been restored in certain cases, now we have to make decisions as tribal nations. We have to decide, how are we going to exercise this restored authority? Are we going to implement the same kinds of systems that we see at the state level? We know that those systems aren't particularly victim-centered. So are we going to replicate those, or are we going to think outside of that and come up with some systems that are fair to defendants, but do a better job of making sure that victims don't fall through the cracks?
Isn't there a patchwork of tribal courts around the country? How would you, start to see reform happening on a nationwide level?
Well, it's difficult because there are over 566 federally recognized tribes, and each one of those is going to have a very different approach. What I do think will be helpful is, as tribes are able to think about new ways of addressing rape, they can certainly share their journeys with other tribes. But what works for one tribe might not work for another. And that's why in the book I advocate, each individual community coming together and having these difficult discussions and coming up with something that's going to work for their community.
And so how also can people and the federal government, I should say, facilitate that process? Because, of course, it's important to preserve the limited sovereignty that tribal nations have within the United States. But on the other hand, as we've said earlier, rape is part of a complex of social ills that are part of a historical and current legacy.
Yeah. So the laws that are in place, they really facilitate rape because they don't hold people accountable. So we need more federal reform.
And what do you mean by they don't hold people accountable? Aren't rapists able to be prosecuted and tried?
They absolutely are on a technical level, but it's just not happening. We just don't see the numbers of rapists that, to be fair, they're very difficult cases to prosecute. Right. And that's because of the Anglo-American system that really, puts the victim on trial instead of the perpetrator. What was she doing that night? What was she wearing that night, right? Those things are still happening. But what the federal government, in my mind, the obligation of the federal government is a trust responsibility and in many cases treaty obligations to make sure that, that tribal nations are safe and that they can govern themselves. So if the federal government is serious about addressing rape, then they will restore jurisdiction and they will provide resources for infrastructure so that tribes do have the resources to take these cases on their own terms.
Finally, what role has President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama played in addressing such issues in Native communities? They've certainly been more interactive with tribal communities than other presidents have been. They've tackled the issue of youth unemployment, of poverty, of education within these communities. Have they also taken on the issue of rape and sexual violence?
I would say yes. I mean, President Obama was, in his administration, I should say, was very much in support of these changes to the Violence Against Women Act. And it was a quite disturbing time period where the Republican powers were very much opposed to restoring jurisdiction and were willing to tank the Violence Against Women Act as a whole just over this question, which tells you that they're very scared for some reason of tribal jurisdiction. But the administration held firm with the, you know, support of the advocates and grassroots, you know, communities and said, no, you know, this is something that Obama wants to leave as his legacy, is to help tribes return to being vibrant and safe places to be.
Sarah, we talked about women victims of rape. What about children?
Well, we certainly have a high rate of child sexual abuse. It's a little bit harder to study that population because, you know, when we're studying adults, you know, they can consent to sharing information and sharing it anonymously. But when you have children and you're trying to study them, you know, that becomes very challenging. Can a child consent to an interview about being victimized? And then do the researchers not have an ethical obligation to report child abuse? So we just don't have the same kinds of numbers, but we can extrapolate from what we know. And one of the most disturbing pieces of data that has come out of the look at Native children is that Native children, on the whole, experience the same rates of PTSD as soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. It's the same level.
And so finally, let's also talk about the issue of how we changed popular culture and how we changed the issue of invisibility, which you mentioned earlier, and you know, stop relying on these reductive stereotypes that show up during times like Halloween, and I should say what's coming up, which is Thanksgiving.
Sure. Well, the dealing with invisibility is hard because it's very rare for an Indian topic to, you know, be picked up by the mainstream media or to be picked up in prime time. And so it's often, you know, radio outlets and progressive news agencies that cover these issues. But we really need to push the issues up to the level of broad awareness, because I think, you know, most of the time when I talk about this issue to non-Native audiences, you know, people come up to me with tears in their eyes. I feel so guilty. I didn't know. I'd never heard of this. Why didn't I hear of this? And, you know, I can't blame somebody for not hearing something that was never presented to them.
Well, your book, I'm sure, goes a long way towards changing those attitudes. Sarah Deer, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah Deer is a professor of law at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her book is called The Beginning and End of Rape: Confronting Sexual Violence in Native America.